This is the time set for oral argument in Hilt versus District Court, with the real party in interest being the City of Henderson. The case number is 79605. This is a virtual argument, and it is being webcast for the morning session of it, the first half of it, to UNLV Boyd School of Law. And at the conclusion of the oral arguments, we'll adjourn briefly and reconvene on a blue jeans format with the law students so that they can have a question and answer period with the lawyers. I know that I received word this morning that we also have several Las Vegas high school classes that are watching oral argument this morning. I think it's Cheyenne and Canyon Springs, so I want to welcome the students from those schools as well. This is unusual to be doing a virtual oral argument that started in March with the COVID pandemic, and we have been holding all of our arguments virtually, which poses some challenges, but it's been remarkably seamless. What I would like to do before we actually put the lawyers on the clock and start the argument is ask each of the attorneys to briefly address the students at UNLV Boyd and at the two high schools that are participating. Introduce yourself and give a brief sketch of the case and its issues. You will not be on the clock. And then when each of you is done, we'll go ahead and formally call the case. So Ms. Nelson, as counsel for the petitioner, could you go first, please?
Absolutely. Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Kimberly Nelson, and as the court had stated, I am here on behalf of Petitioner Roman Hilt. The issue before the court is the effect of the Anderson decision on the retroactivity or prospectivity as it applies to Hilt. This is a unique situation where the Hilt writ was filed one day after the Anderson decision, which is what brings us here today to determine how the Anderson decision applies to Petitioner Hilt's case.
Thank you very much. Mr. Shifalakwa, and could you briefly educate our listeners to what is the Anderson case?
Yes, of course. Thank you very much. My name is Mark Shifalakwa. I'm the head of the criminal division for the Henderson City Attorney's Office. We prosecute misdemeanor offenses that happen in the city of Henderson, including DUI and domestic violence. So this is a domestic violence case. And the Supreme Court last year decided the Anderson decision. And what that said is because there was a change in the law about having your gun rights stripped away if you got a domestic violence conviction, a misdemeanor conviction, that you were entitled to a jury trial as opposed to a trial in front of a judge. All of our cases and misdemeanors before that were simply decided by a judge, not a jury. So this is about how far back in time does that decision reach? Who does it affect? And then how do the municipal courts handle that?
Thank you very much. In a moment, I'll ask the council to begin their oral argument. But for the students watching, you'll see a clock in your screen, depending on how you have your display, that says 15 minutes. What that signifies is that each lawyer gets 15 minutes allotted to them to talk to the court about the issues in their case and why they think they should win and the other side should lose. The 15-minute clock will run, and then when you're 5 minutes away from its expiration, it'll turn yellow from green, and then it turns red when you're right at 15 minutes. The lawyers use that to track their oral argument time. And the petitioner or the appellant, the one who has really the burden of showing error by the district court, they go first, and if they want, they can reserve some time for what's called rebuttal. That gives them the first and the last word, trying to convince the court that the trial court committed an error that should cause this court to reverse. So with that, I would like to ask Ms. Nelson if she's prepared to proceed and whether she reserves any time for rebuttal.
Yes, Your Honor, I am prepared to begin, and I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Very well, thank you.
Good morning. My name is Kimberly Nelson, Nevada bar number 15295. May it please the court. The brief submitted in this matter focused the brunt of analysis on whether, after the issuance of the Anderson decision, Petitioner Hilt's conviction was final for purposes of determining whether or not the Anderson decision would apply retroactively or prospectively to Hilt. This question seems promptly resolved when acknowledging that Mr. Hilt's conviction is our case is not yet final and was thus not final when Anderson was decided. The more important analysis surely lies on an issue that was only touched upon in the briefs. Specifically, was a rule announced in Anderson or was it in effect on the date of passing of NRS 202-360 on 10-1-2015? The amendment of NRS 202-360 on 10-1-2015, not Anderson, was when the rule became effective, entitling a defendant charged with misdemeanor battery constituting domestic violence to a jury trial. Colwell tells us that Anderson did not announce a new rule because it merely interpreted and clarified existing rules. The court in Anderson makes this clear by explaining that it is this amendment, NRS 202-360, that distinguishes the instant matter, Anderson, from Amezcua, and commands the conclusion that misdemeanor domestic battery is a serious offense. Blanton tells us that the state legislature will indicate whether a misdemeanor crime is deemed serious depending on the additional punishments beyond the maximum period of incarceration of 6 months. Amezcua takes this analysis one step further. In Amezcua, the court found that misdemeanor battery constituting domestic violence was not a serious offense in Nevada, determining that the loss of a firearm right was the result of federal law and thus was only a collateral consequence, and that only direct consequences prescribed by the Nevada legislature will elevate an offense from petty to serious. Just 1 year after the decision in Amezcua, the Nevada legislature amended NRS 202-360 to prohibit any individual convicted of misdemeanor battery constituting domestic violence to own or possess a firearm. In doing so, the legislature followed the guidance from Blanton and Amezcua and made it clear that in Nevada, misdemeanor battery constituting domestic violence is a serious offense. It's at that moment the rule became effective. Anderson merely interpreted and clarified the effect of NRS 202-360 amended subsequent to the guidance from Blanton and Amezcua.
Ms. Nelson, does it matter for purposes of our review, does it matter whether or not we treat this as a writ of mandamus or a writ of certiorari?
It does matter for purposes going forward, depending on if Anderson is determined to be a new rule or not. Should Anderson be determined to be a new rule, we know that then we must look at the finality of Hilt as to whether or not Anderson would apply prospectively to Mr. Hilt's case. And treating this as a writ of cert would be premature, as depending the conclusion of this court's decision, Mr. Hill still has the ability, per the United States Supreme Court Rule 13, to file a writ of cert with the United States Supreme Court to for this decision.
Does it matter whether the district court or this court is the court of last resort for purposes of your client?
For purposes of Mr. Hilt, it does not matter if this is the case, court of last resort, or if it's the United States Supreme Court. However, I believe that our it's believed that the United States Supreme Court would, in fact, be the court of last resort, as Mr. Hilt still has not exercised his right to file a writ before that court.
Does that apply? The Anderson decision was resolved on both state constitutional and federal constitutional grounds. And if it had been resolved entirely on state constitutional grounds, such that the U.S. Supreme Court would not have taken it, does the rule that you're calculating your time from when certiorari to that court expires still apply?
I believe, yes, it does. The time calculated to file a writ of cert would be upon the remitter being issued of this court, in which the 90 days would then begin to start.
The remitter issued from district court to the municipal court, correct? Before you ran the writ to this court?
Correct.
And you ran a writ of mandamus or habeas, and you did not run, Nevada has a writ of certiorari too. And looking at subparagraph 3 of our certiorari statute, where the district court rules on the constitutionality of a statute, there's a writ of certiorari available to this court. And it struck me in preparing for this case to question why you did not run a Nevada writ of certiorari to this court.
And that's an excellent question. I was not even licensed to practice law when this writ was filed with the court, so I cannot speak to what my predecessors and employers, their intention was as far as why they chose a writ of habeas corpus or in the alternative writ of mandamus, but I trust their wisdom and experience in making that decision.
Good answer. I think you still have a job.
Yeah.
But a follow-up question nonetheless. If the appropriate writ was a writ of certiorari, should we treat the writ petition for mandamus or habeas corpus as one for certiorari? Can we do that?
I do not have a strong answer to that question.
Thank you.
Counsel, as the Chief points out, this is Justice Hardesty, as the Chief points out, Anderson was decided under both federal and state constitutional grounds. So does the issue that is presented in her question relevant since the U.S. Constitution was also a grounds for the Anderson decision?
Could you clarify your question?
The Chief's question was couched in terms of a writ of certiorari in Nevada based upon Anderson's holding as it related to the Nevada Constitution. But Anderson, of course, relied also on the U.S. Constitution. So my question is, even if perhaps one should have filed a writ of certiorari with this court on this issue, does it matter for purposes of your argument here because the Anderson decision rested equally on the U.S. Constitution?
It does not.
So, counsel, this is Justice Kadish here in Carson City. So you started out arguing that, in fact, Anderson is not a new rule, which I guess would make it apply to your client and others. Given that it was an overruling of Amescua, how is it not a new rule?
Anderson is not a new rule. It merely interpreted and clarified previous rules in Blanton and Amezcua upon the effectuation of NRS 202-360. In fact, the Anderson decision states that given the legislator had indicated that the offense of misdemeanor domestic battery is serious, it follows that one facing the charge is entitled to a right to jury trial. Given that language, it appears that upon the enactment of NRS 202-360, it naturally follows that because NRS 202-360 elevated that offense to serious, that it was an automatic attachment and a right of entitlement to a jury trial per the U.S. Constitution and Nevada Constitution. Anderson merely clarified that effectuation date.
Did she reserve any time?
I don't know.
Okay. So then if it's a new rule, let's just contemplate that. If we were to decide it's a new rule, how would that affect your client? Would it still be applicable to your client?
Yes, it would be. If Anderson is found to be the new rule, it would still apply prospectively to Petitioner Hilt's case as his conviction is not yet final per the analysis under Colwell. As the third prong, the time to file a petition of writ of cert to the Supreme Court of the United States or to have filed and had been denied that same petition for writ has not expired. That time will not start until after remitter has been issued from this court following this decision.
And sorry, just one more very quick question, which is probably obvious to everyone but me. Has the sentence for Mr. Hilt been stayed while this is before us?
Yes, it has been.
Okay, so he hasn't had to serve it yet, so it hasn't been mooted.
Correct.
Okay.
Ms. Nelson, this is Justice Hardesty again. I don't know if you misspoke or you intended to argue this, but in responding to Justice Silver's question about the third prong in Colwell as to what is the court of last resort, isn't that prong focused on what is the state court of last resort? In our Constitution, as you know, appeals from municipal courts go to the district court, not to the Nevada Supreme Court. And so the question, isn't it, is which is the, which between the district court in Nevada and the Supreme Court in Nevada is the state court of last resort? Isn't that what we must resolve?
I think that issue has possibly already been resolved in Blanton in determining, is this matter, Petitioner Hill's case, available to continue to the United States Supreme Court pending this court's decision. The procedural steps taken here mimic those that were already taken in Blanton. A jury trial issue in front of municipal court, denied writ in front of district court, oral arguments heard before the Nevada Supreme Court, and then writ of cert issued or granted to the United States Supreme Court in which oral arguments were held. So that is guiding petitioner's stance that the writ of cert may continue upon this decision to the United States Supreme Court. And I only have a minute left, so may I reserve that time?
Very well. You have 56 seconds left. Do you want to reserve that for your rebuttal time?
Yes, please.
I will add a minute to that and round it up to a full 2 minutes, and I'll add a minute to Mr. Shifalakwa's time as well. We asked you quite a few questions, and this process of doing this virtually is a bit cumbersome, so thank you. Mr. Shifalakwa, are you prepared to proceed?
I am. Thank you very much. Thank you, Chief Justice, and may it please the court, Mark Skifalakwa for the City of Henderson. On October 17th of 2017, Michelle Hilt was physically abused by her husband, Roman Hilt. He was arrested, he was charged by my office, and he was found guilty beyond a reasonable doubt of domestic violence. The district court, sitting in its appellate capacity, fully affirmed the conviction and the appeal was closed. Both judges followed faithfully the prevailing constitutional law when deciding the case, and no one debates this. But today, petitioner is asking this court to take the highly unusual step to overturn his conviction based upon a procedural rule that was unknown to both the trial court and appellate court.
Well, Justice Hardesty, if I may intervene.
Yes.
Isn't it the case that Mr. Hilt requested a jury trial of the municipal court when his case came before the municipal court, and he repeated that request or that opportunity in his appeal to the district court? Isn't that the case?
That is correct, Your Honor. The question, I think, on retroactivity is not whether the issue was preserved. We can't always anticipate that litigants will argue something that isn't the law. But at the time, what was the law? So I don't disagree. I'm sorry.
I thought you had stopped. Did you want to finish that, and then I'll have a question?
Okay, fair enough. I don't disagree that it was brought up. But I don't think it needs to be brought up when we're talking about our retroactivity analysis. Preservation isn't necessarily the issue. It's what did the judges know at the time, and did they follow the law, and was then the case closed? Thank you.
Mr. Shifalakwa, this is Justice Silver in Las Vegas. So I have a question regarding that retroactivity, which has been announced. Why isn't the exception from Caldwell allowing retroactivity of a new criminal rule the case here, where the new rule establishes a procedure without which the likelihood of an accurate conviction is seriously diminished? Doesn't a jury trial set us apart from most other countries around the world because it ensures that a defendant charged with a crime, especially battery domestic violence, receives a fair trial? So why doesn't the Caldwell exception apply in this case?
That's a great question, Your Honor. I guess it goes to, why do we have jury trials? Do we have them because we don't trust our judges? Or do we have them because it's based on our founding? At some point, we've said that when penalties get so lofty, they get so weighty, we have a jury of our peers make the decision. I was thinking of the words, I did a trial years ago in front of Judge Stuart Bell, and he said something to the jury at the end that I think is a good answer to the question. He says, when the government brings a big case, this was a pimp case, big allegations, big charges, we don't have the government decide. We have the people decide. And that's a good way to put it. But it's not as though we don't trust our lower court judges. And I think Caldwell, Darrow really talked about this. We don't have it because we don't trust them, or we think they're always getting it wrong. If that was the case, we wouldn't let them handle speeding tickets. Especially this judge, Your Honor, more on the micro level, who decided this case, one of the more experienced and respected members of the lower court bench. So we have jury trials because of the weight of the penalty, and not because we don't trust our judges as fact finders. We certainly do. And I believe Caldwell noted that we don't have it for accuracy purposes.
But you would agree Mr. Shifalakwa, sorry. Before you move on, you would agree that your opponent tendered and the district court rejected the argument that constitutionally he was entitled to a jury trial.
Yes, Your Honor, and that's a very good point because it brings us into finality. What is the purpose of finality? And Justice Harlan and then this court has talked about it. What do we want our judges to do? And I think the answer is simple. Our lower court judges, trial and lower appellate courts. And that's follow the constitutional rules that you've set and the Supreme Court of the United States have set. That's what we want them to do. And if they're doing that and the appeal is closed out, we're not going to go back in time and make the state bring in all these witnesses again when everybody did everything according to the law as it was known at the time. Law can evolve, but what do we want our lower court judges to do? Follow it. Follow the law that we have on the books at that time. And they certainly did that here.
Mr. Shifalakwa, I have another question. It's Justice Silver. In Talley versus California, The United States Supreme Court granted a petition of certiorari challenging, which had challenged the misdemeanor conviction. How is Hilt's conviction final in this case? Because he could have filed a writ of certiorari with the United States Supreme Court under the United States Supreme Court Rule 13.1.
That's another good question. My answer is two parts. One, and I think some of the other justices touched on this, it's important to know why we're here today. We are here today on mandamus. And we're here, which is an extraordinary remedy, and it's second, meaning the appeals already happened. Rule 21 talks about our petitions for extraordinary review to this court, and there's no filing line. It's only governed by laches. As you know, appeals have filing deadlines. There's a notice of appeal, and then you do your appeal, and then the appeal is decided. But that's not the case in mandamus, and that's important. The second important part, Your Honor, is if we take counsel's argument that I get my trial, I get my appeal, now I get my petition to your court, and then I get another petition to the U.S. Supreme Court, and that's final for me. Well, that's going to create some absurdity because it's building in an extra legal challenge, appellate challenge, that you wouldn't give a felony. If we think of a felony, we have trial, we have appeal, it's in the state court of last resort, your court on the felony, and then you have the 90 days. That's your finality. A new rule comes out during then, it applies. Misdemeanor law, what they're saying is, I want my trial, I want my appeal, but not only that, now I want an extra writ that has no filing deadline, I can file it later, and then my 90 days. It would make misdemeanors endless as part of finality. There's a line in Sciarro which really, I think, hits home. 357 of the decision. Right to a jury trial is fundamental to our system, but it does not follow that when a criminal has had a full round of a full trial and one round of appeals, in which the state faithfully applied the Constitution as we understood it at the time, that he may nevertheless continue to litigate his claims in hopes that we'll have a change of heart. It's one round of appeal, and that's why this is so important. Finality always talks about direct review. Are you on direct review? All of our prior case law has been felonies, so it's frankly assumed that you were in the state court of last resort. But as Justice mentioned earlier, you're not there on misdemeanors. You can never come before this court on direct review of a misdemeanor.
So, Mr. Skifalakwa?
Wait, because we've gotten a lot of them from the city of Henderson, so I'm just curious on that.
Yes. May I answer? I'm sorry.
This is Justice Kadish. So let's assume for a moment you're correct. Let's assume the district court is the state court of last resort for a moment. Even if that's true, and I understand your argument on that, under the U.S. Supreme Court Rule 13.1, didn't they then have a 90-day period after the district court judgment to file for certiorari there, and then isn't it true that their judgment, that the conviction wasn't final until after either resolution of a cert petition to Supreme Court or a failure to file one within the 90 days? And then if that's true, didn't they seek this writ from us before that finality?
Thank you for the question. The last part of the finality rule wouldn't apply. Here's what's clear. The state court of last resort is certainly the Nevada Supreme Court. Direct review is different. Direct review can only occur in the district court, but it is not the state court of last review for the entire state of Nevada. That is certainly this court. So my point is, he doesn't have the right from the denial of the direct appeal in district court to leapfrog this court and go directly to the U.S. Supreme Court. The U.S. Supreme Court can only take petitions for cert from the Nevada Supreme Court, not from a lower court. So to go to your second point about, well, couldn't he file a petition for discretionary review, which is why we're here today, with this body, and if you deny it, then file a petition with the U.S. Supreme Court. That is absolutely possible. That's how Blanton went, this court to the U.S. Supreme Court. But that's not what I'm saying, because The district court is the end of direct appellate review, and that's what we need to look at. One appeal, not two.
But counsel,
and we
if
build
I could...
in a whole... I apologize.
No, you finish your thought, and then I'll ask my question. I apologize myself. I thought
you
finished, yeah.
There's a half a second delay, so I apologize. What I would say is that you can only go to the U.S. Supreme Court from the state court of last report. That's this court. But it also has to be from direct review. It can't come from an intermediary writ, because then we're building in two appeals for misdemeanors that will make it endless under mandamus, and we're not doing that for felonies. Felonies would be definite, misdemeanors not. Thank you.
I appreciate your argument on that, but as was asked of you earlier by Justice Silver, in Talley versus California, a 1960 U.S. Supreme Court decision, what is taking place in determining the court of last resort is exactly what happened in that case. The U.S. Supreme Court entertained a writ of certiorari to the U.S. Supreme Court where there was a constitutional claim stemming from a municipal court conviction. I don't see any case law that alters the Talley decision or changes it. I don't know. I wanted to get your take on that case because it would seem in this instance that under the Nevada Constitution, where there is an appeal from a municipal court or a justice of the peace, the court of last resort is the district court. That's how our Constitution is structured. So if there is a constitutional claim, as there is in this case, or it rises under the Anderson decision, why wouldn't the Talley case apply in this circumstance? You've made the point, and I'm trying to contrast the point you've made, that the only method to getting to the U.S. Supreme Court where there's a constitutional claim arising out of a municipal court conviction is by going through the Nevada Supreme Court. But that's not what happened in Talley, and counsel's argument is we could have done that here.
Thank you, Judge. There is a case, Gonzalez versus Thaler, U.S. Supreme Court case that came out after. Wasn't a misdemeanor, but it's 565 U.S. 134. Justice Sotomayor, towards the end of the opinion, it's 154 of the opinion, talked about how they interpret that Rule 13, that they can't take a case from an intermediary appellate court of a state. It's got to come to the state's highest court, the court of last resort. Now, that could be the state or it could be the U.S. Court of Appeals if it was a federal case. And so while it's certainly the end of the appeal in the district court, it's not the end of everything. There could be a seeking discretionary review, and that's the danger here, is if we give it to this case and we don't have some constrictions on this, you can kind of see what would happen. Everyone convicted of domestic violence would file a petition for mandamus, not to necessarily be successful, but to toll finality. And we can't set finality by an extraordinary writ with no filing deadline. We want our judges to follow the rules, and if they did that, they generally should be respected. I know I'm short on time, so I have
Well, I have a question.
Yes,
I'm sorry,
of course, sir.
Mr. Shifalakwa, one question I have, and nobody is addressing it, is NRS 34.020 addresses the Nevada, the availability of a writ of certiorari from a district court to the Nevada Supreme Court. And it says in subparagraph 3, in any case prosecuted for the violation of a statute or municipal ordinance wherein an appeal has been taken from a municipal court and wherein the district court has passed upon the constitutionality or validity of the statute or ordinance, the writ, certiorari, shall be granted by the appellate court of competent jurisdiction pursuant to rules fixed by the Supreme Court of the upon application of the state or municipality or the defendant for the purpose of reviewing the constitutionality or validity of such statute or ordinance. To me, we have a very specific statutory writ procedure, not mandamus, not habeas, but certiorari, from the district court to the Nevada Supreme Court or possibly the Court of Appeals. And I'm concerned about how that affects these arguments. And I'll give you an extra minute to answer on this because I'm taking up your time. But why shouldn't this have been done by writ of certiorari, and how does that affect the analysis of when this conviction became final?
Thank you very much, Your Honor. I think the question is, did the lower courts pass upon the constitutionality of an ordinance or of a statute? They certainly didn't find the domestic violence laws illegal or unconstitutional in any way. To go back to the point, though, with how we file our extraordinary petitions, that would also be covered under Rule 21 of our appellate procedure rules without a filing deadline. And I think you can kind of glean from what I'm saying is the concern is, first of all, certainly this is a new rule. No one was doing this practice before Anderson, and this is obviously new. It wasn't dictated by our legal precedent. So who can avail themselves? If there is a 90-day window from your appeal in the district court, certainly that's at least some arms around that. That's some guidelines. But I don't see that in Rule 21 of the appellate procedure rules, and that's the danger, is if we give it to this defendant, I don't know what stops somebody from filing it today, which was a year later after Anderson, and saying the same thing. Well, I can go here, and then I can go there, and now I have way longer than the felony. I do want to thank you very much for your questions, and thank you for your attention to this case.
Thank you very much. Ms. Nelson, you have 2 minutes.
Thank you. Before I begin, are there any questions from the court that I may answer?
Yes, I have one. Justice Silver, you heard both Justice Hardesty and myself ask regarding the Talley case and how it arrived at the United States Supreme Court through a misdemeanor conviction in the lower municipal court in California. Then the state brought up that somehow it's distinguishable through the Gonzalez case. And what Justice Sotomayor had mentioned, that writs of certiorari should come from the Supreme Court to the state. Can you address what Mr. Shifalakwa just stated regarding that and regarding Talley?
Yes, I have not read the Gonzalez decision that was referenced, so I will do my best. As far as the Nevada Supreme Court and the only way to get the writ of cert to the Supreme Court, in Cody H. Versus the 8th Judicial District, we know that generally the United States or the Nevada Supreme Court will not entertain a writ of mandamus if a petitioner has a plain and speedy adequate remedy in the ordinary course of law. However, we know from history that the Nevada Supreme Court will consider a petition if it presents an important question of law that needs clarification and is with interest to sound judicial economy and administration favoring consideration of the petition. So we know that the possibility for us to be here exists, not only because we are here, but because prior cases have procedurally done the same. In that situation, we are then afforded the United States Supreme Court Rule 13, in which we may file a petition of writ of cert following the decision issued in this case.
Thank you. Do any of my colleagues in Carson City or Las Vegas have any questions? I want to thank counsel for their arguments. We will be at ease for 5 minutes while the IT department reconvenes this in a Blue Jeans meeting in which the UNLV Boyd students may participate. That question and answer will be webcast, and I didn't have sufficient advance notice with the two high schools to arrange for them to also participate, but they're more than welcome to watch that question and answer, and we certainly appreciate their interest in this proceeding. So we'll be at ease for 5 minutes and resume at that.